Hi, this is Marek Sabrisky, and it's great to be with you on our podcast, The Calling, here. We've got Andrew Boyer with me, who's shares in all these podcasts. Andrew, it's great to have you here.
Yeah, good to be back. You seem to get all the good gets. You have, like, the top baseball writer, and now today you have, like, the top golf writer, so I'm impressed.
Yeah, we call him the poet laureate of golf, and that's what he's been called. Michael Bamberger is an old friend. He was born and raised in Patchogue, New York. He attended public schools, wrote for the local newspaper, played golf on public courses there, and then he graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 1982, and he became a reporter for the Vineyard Gazette on Martha's Vineyard. He joined the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1986 and became a senior writer for Sports Illustrated starting in 1995. He's the author of 7 nonfiction books and the co-author of 1 novel, including Wonderland, A Year in the Life of American High School, which may be made into a movie sometime in the future. But other books include The Swinger, 2011, a novel he wrote with fellow Sports Illustrated writer Alan Chipnuck. It's a satire on the Tiger Woods sex scandal. And then followed up by The Second Life of Tiger Woods in 2020, which covers Tiger's win at the 2019 Masters. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much. That was a delight. Owing to the fact that this is a church-oriented podcast, I think with fair warning, maybe we should omit any references to The Swinger because it really moves towards R and possibly beyond at points. But I think all the other books are good family reading, and I guess some of the parishioners would – I don't think any of the parishioners would not recognize some of the scenes in The Swinger.
Oh, well, they all want to see that made into a movie, so we'll see how that goes. Well, listen, the Masters winner on Easter Sunday was John Rahm of Spain, and the second-place finishers were Phil Mickelson, who is 52, remarkable, and Brooks Koepka, who had a rules issue. So of these three, who were you rooting for?
Yes, the Masters this couple of weeks ago, the Spaniard John Rahm won, and 2 American golfers who now play on the LIV Tour, Phil Mickelson and Brooks Koepka, finished second. And I was actively rooting for John Rahm for a lot of different reasons, one of which is he has, and he did this in English, not his first language, pledged his fealty, F-E-A-L-T-Y. How many people who don't speak English as their native language are going to use that word, to the PGA Tour? And I grew up on the PGA Tour. You know, I feel connected to the PGA Tour, so I respond to that. The other two guys have jumped ship. They've grabbed the easy money. This is easy for me to judge, and Saudi easy money at that. But I also love the way this John Rahm plays. There's a tradition of Spanish golf that even if you don't follow golf closely, you would probably pick up on it. And the most famous by far, the Arnold Palmer of Spanish golf and really European golf, is someone named Seve Ballesteros, who came to prominence in the mid 1970s. And there's just a flair, like there is to a lot of Spaniards, and you know, whether it's Picasso or
Nadal,
Nadal or anywhere else, they just play with a certain. Nadal is a kind of a different creature, I think, but Ballesteros had it. 2 other Spanish golfers, one particular, Sergio Garcia, has it to some degree, or maybe a significant degree. Another golfer named Jose Maria Lothabal. All 3 of these guys have won the Masters. I mean, it's a country of only 50 million people. Now it's produced 4 Masters winners with this John Rahm, and they all have expressive faces. How about you, Andrew? Who are you rooting for down the stretch?
I was rooting for was Bennett, the amateur, who, you know, was in 9th place, I guess.
Yeah.
I thought that was amazing. I thought that it was incredible that he might, like, be able to get, like, this, you know, million-dollar purse and not be able to have it. and all these other guys. I actually thought, what would happen if you know, he's standing over a putt and the other's got, I'll give you $1 million to miss that putt. It doesn't cost you anything, and it's worth $1 million to me.
Yes.
So, anyway, I like that.
Well, the Masters always emphasizes amateur golfers in the field. Why is that?
Yes. Andrew, why is that?
I guess it's always been part of the Augusta thing. And in fact, there was this great amateur golfer they were talking about who, I guess, came in 2nd.
You know, I don't know about second place finishers, but there have been some close calls. Billy Joe Patton definitely contended in a Masters. You have definitely the basic idea, but it's really one central reason. I know Miracle knows his name because he's a Southerner and he's a little older. And I'll be curious. Do you know the name Bobby Jones? Is that a name you're familiar with?
Sure, yeah. Okay. That's, yeah.
So Bobby Jones was the great amateur golfer of the golden age of sport, late 20s, early 30s. And he founded Augusta National, if I may use this phrase, in his image.
Mm-hmm.
Is that phrase okay to use?
Yeah.
In a non-biblical sense?
Yeah.
But he did. He found the club in his image, and his image was the committed amateur golfer. So when he started this invitational tournament, the Masters, at the club that he co-founded with a man named Cliff Roberts, he always wanted amateurs to be part of it. So the Augusta National officials go out of their way to make sure that there's an amateur presence. The U.S. amateur winner gets in, the runner-up gets in, the British amateur winner gets in, and a few mid-amateur and a few others as well. And they're feted and dined. They stay in a special and there's an attic apartment in the clubhouse called the Crow's Nest. And so what the gent you're talking about, Steve Bennett, 22-year-old kid. Well, to your point about, you know, I'll pay you $1 million, Mrs. Putt. Well, one of the things you have to do if you win the U.S. Amateur, which you would typically do in August of 1 year, then you qualify all automatically for the next April's Masters if you do one thing. You know what that one thing is?
Go pro.
Don't go pro. If you go pro, you lose your right to play. So guys do that all the time. They stay amateur longer than they might otherwise because they want to play in the Masters as an amateur because they may never get there again. Lots of other reasons too.
But this guy clearly could do it because he was, you know, able to keep up with the field. He was amazing.
Yes.
Wow. So how excited were you to see Mickelson come in second?
Well, I have a lot of experience with Phil Mickelson and a lot of ambivalence about him. But the most extraordinary thing is at 50, he won a PGA championship. He's the oldest golfer ever to win a major championship. And at 52, he was a second place finisher in the Masters. He's strong as an ox. His body has never broken down. He's got a spectacular, long, flowing, athletic swing. He plays with a tremendous amount of swagger. And he's been great for golf. He signs every last autograph. Fans gravitate to him. But there's always something else going on with Phil. It's just like in his nature. And you kind of always feel like he's playing it a little bit. And I think he sort of is. And I think maybe that's like part of the game to him. But for one reason or another, I can't fully embrace Phil. Although I have great friends who fully embrace Phil. But I like him because he's likable. He's great with his wife and his kids and his fans. He's great with reporters. I don't know what it is.
I have a problem with Phil.
All right.
My problem with Phil is that he's 6'4", and I'm 6'4", and I'm a terrible golfer, and I blame it on the fact that I'm too tall.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's harder for tall people, and then Phil blows that out of the water and makes it.
If this makes you feel any better, having spent, well, I'm 6'1", or maybe I once was, he wouldn't be 6'4".
Yeah.
He's not that tall. But height is not an advantage in golf.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it is.
Yeah.
Well, and then how does golf get such a a massive hold on people's lives that, you know, they say it's been called a good walk spoiled, and it can be so frustrating. I've often, when I've said to people, if they've, you know, shot a round of golf, I said, how'd it go? I said, oh God, it was so frustrating. And I'm thinking, it's an expensive sport to frustrate.
And yourself. A long sport.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What is it that gets, you know, like Andrew and I play a lot of tennis, but I don't hear people rave or feel almost like addicted to tennis the way they get addicted to golf.
You know, there's a joke that covers this broad area, and I credit Michael Murphy, the author of Golf in the Kingdom, with this guy who founded. Are you familiar with the Esalen Institute, by any chance? Mm-hmm. He was co-founded by a man named Michael Murphy, who's 92, and absolutely, a totally, completely remarkable person. But anyway, I believe that he says that who knew that golf is yoga for Republicans? But it does, you know. Now, I do some yoga-like things, but I don't have that spiritual part at all. I'm just sort of like grunting and getting through it. But when it comes to golf, most people that I know that that I play golf with, yes, it's a deep hold on you. And there's a number of different reasons for that. One is it's so mental. that ball is stationary. In most sports, the ball is moving. It's coming at you. You've got to react. With the ball stationary, you're over the ball. You have ideas in your head. You've got to transmit those ideas literally into your body and then get your body to do something to propel the ball forward. So it's engaging every part of your body, to start starting with the mind and then to the body. And then there's the aspect of literally being in nature. Now, you guys play tennis. You're playing tennis in the winter in Greenwich, Connecticut. You're doing it indoors. Golf is an outdoor sport. Anything that can get us outdoors in this life of ours, we welcome. I think we crave the opportunity to be outdoors. And it's a wonderful opportunity to practice empathy, because whatever struggle your golfing partner is having, you're going to have it at some point. And if he's losing, he or she is losing, you know, his or her golf ball, you're going to lose your golf ball at some point too. If you're going to help them with the search, they're going to help you with the search. So there's a mutual connection between golfers, and then there are other aspects too. Because as you get farther along in golf, you get interested in the engineering behind the golf club, the architecture of the clubhouse, the sociology of club life. You and I have observed a lot of that at the Cricket Club over the years. When I joined the Philadelphia Cricket Club in the late 80s, I think about 87, I was one of the very few Jewish members of the club. It was just like, it was an old-time Quaker club and Protestant club. And it changed over the years as things changed. But the sociology of club life, every aspect, engineering, history, I mean, it all sort of, there's something to engage almost every interest that you might have, an aspect of your personality.
We're going to do something now called the lightning round.
Oh, we're going to lightning round.
This is where Andrew's going to fire questions at you, about 10 of them. We got about 20, 30 seconds.
Yeah, just quick answers. Yeah. Change one rule in golf. What would it be?
Okay, this is so technical, but OB. Right now, OB is shot and distance. For those who know golf, they'll understand what I'm saying. Just drop where it went out. Play it like a lateral hazard.
Yeah. Mine is 12 holes. Cut 6 holes, and I think golf is better. But
you're allowed to do that, Andrew. Yeah, no one says you have to play holes 13 through 18. You could walk in.
What golf course do you think is the closest to your ideal?
Well, I love the National Golf Links in Southampton. It's sort of my idea of heaven, except that it's so extremely exclusive. So I always have to factor that in. I'm very much drawn to public golf courses for that reason. And I guess really the short answer would be the Old Course in St. Andrews, because it is public and it's spectacular.
So
it's in a great town.
What's the most overrated or disappointing course?
Oof, wow. Any number of these resort courses in Nevada or in Las Vegas or Phoenix, I wouldn't want to cite them by name, but expensive, slow, golf in a cart. There's a lot of it in this country. By the way, there's not a lot in other countries, but there are hundreds of them in this country, and I really have no use
for it. Like all of Myrtle Beach.
No, but, you know, Myrtle Beach has some very charming golf courses, but I know what you're saying, but I would say more Vegas.
Vegas, yeah. Who's a pro golfer with the best sense of humor?
Well, David Ferrerty, who's now a LIV Golf announcer, played the European Tour for years, and is a very, very witty person. Almost manically witty, but I would say Ferrerty is the first person that comes to mind.
Who's a woman golfer that everyone should know?
Well, a woman golfer that everyone should know about, she's now deceased, is Mickey Wright, and many don't. Andrew, do you know the name Mickey Wright?
I don't. I only know two women golfers.
Mickey Wright is, do you know the name Ben Hogan?
I do, yeah.
Okay, Mickey Wright is the Ben Hogan of women's golf, and anybody who's interested really knowing something about golf should know something about Mickey Wright.
Okay, we're going to make a bet, or if we were going to make a bet, and you're going to set the odds, percent chance that the LIV Tour will exist in 10 years.
I'll say high, because I don't think the Saudi money spigot isn't going to be turned off anytime soon, and I think they're going to get. I think the Saudi government and the Saudi ruling class is going to get what they want out of LIV Golf.
Okay, so like 90% likely to be around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have $10,000 to spend on improving somebody's golf game. Let's say somebody terrible like me. How would you spend the $10,000?
I would go to an Apple store and buy a MacBook and get on YouTube and look up golf swings.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. That sounds like that would be cheap. I already have a MacBook. You haven't spent any of the money. So it's not lessons. It's not new clubs. It's not anything.
Figure it out for yourself. Yeah. Hogan said the secret's in the dirt. That means practice.
Yeah.
But you got to know what to practice. And YouTube can tell you what to practice.
Okay. Worst part of your job?
Oof, I love my job. Getting on airplanes.
Okay. Do you think that there will be another dominant, like Tiger Woods, Arnold Palmer? Like, what makes that happen? One person?
Even to cite those two names, there's a chasm between them. Arnold, for charisma, was the all-time. But in terms of what Arnold Palmer did on the golf course and what Tiger Woods did on the golf course, you can't even talk about the two in the same breath. Most people don't realize that. The only one you can really talk about in the same breath, in my opinion, would be Jack Nicklaus. I don't think we're going to see another one. And, of course, part of what makes the Tiger Woods story so remarkable is the way that he grew up.
Right. So it was the Earl Woods effect, right? So is that...
Well, let's not forget Tito Woods. His mom was born in Thailand. I mean, he's a first-generation American on his mother's side. So it's the whole package of... This will never happen again. This particular case, I don't think could ever happen again.
And last part of the lightning round, what's the best golf book that you didn't write?
Well, I would never put my name up, but I'm going to just recommend a book.
Give me a fiction and a nonfiction.
Okay. There's really very little great golf fiction. The short stories. Yes. Okay. That's a great idea.
Or Rick Riley as Missing Links.
Yes. Okay.
I like that book.
No, you're good. That's great stuff. I would agree definitely wholeheartedly with Riley's a friend of mine. It's harder for me to take him seriously in this context of great fiction. But for great nonfiction or just really, really enjoyable, Herbert Warren Wind, who went to Yale, Bernard Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandson, wrote for the Times of London. But just to sort of quick hit it and have some fun with it, a book called The Bogeyman by George Plimpton. He wrote it 50 years ago or more, and it's just great, great fun.
Awesome. That's our lightning round.
Let's keep going. That speed, just we can cover a lot of ground. The title of your book, The Ball in the Air. How did you come up with that?
The ball in the air. The ball in the air is a phrase of golf. People say, oh, let's play 8. Ball's in the air at 8 o'clock. And that means you got to show up at 7:50 to make sure that your ball is in the air at 8 o'clock. So, and part of golf definitely is being punctual. But the bigger part was everyone who listens to this who knows golf will know there's a golf club down the road called Wingfoot. Would you know that name, Eric?
Mm-hmm.
And Wingfoot had a famous pro named Claude Harmon. Claude Harmon was the last club pro to win the Masters. Claude Harmon had 4 sons. The best known of them is Butch Harmon, who taught Tiger Woods how to play golf. The fourth son is a friend of mine named Billy Harmon. And Billy Harmon is a noted teacher in his own right. And I once asked Billy Harmon, what do you like best about the game? And Billy said, the ball in the air. And it was so beautiful, the phrase to me. And it's just like, it gets to the whims that are out of life, that are out of your control. The ball's in the air. It could hit a bird. The wind could hit it. It could hit a tree, and the tree might help it or hurt it. You don't know. There's a lot in life that we can't control. So we control what we can to get the ball in the air. But then once it's in the air, right, all hell might break loose.
Yeah, that's the moment of hope, right? Like, this is nothing but opportunity when it's in the air. And then, right, and then it lands, and it takes a weird bounce, and you're like, oh, God, yes. I hit it beautifully.
Like, and you might know this quote, it might be before your time. Hal Sutton hit the shot into the 72nd hole of the Players' Championship years ago, and that ball is in the air, and he says, be the right club today, with, like, real urgency. Because he doesn't know. He can't really know. He knows he's done his job, but now something's out of his control, and that's why that quote is so famous.
So how did you get started in golf?
My parents fled Nazi Germany as kids. There was no expectation that I was going to go down a path of golf, but I had an eighth grade gym teacher at the public middle school that I attended who was a golf aficionado, and he brought in clubs and plastic mats and little wiffle balls and taught us the grip. And I think there really is this DNA strain of people that are going to get drawn to golf, but I was almost hooked immediately just from the first time of hitting those balls off those plastic mats in gym class at South Ocean Avenue Middle School, where my mom later taught in Patchogue on the South Shore of Long Island.
What does the game mean to you, and why is it such an incredible connector for so many people?
it connects people because everybody has had the same experience of golf. I really truly believe that Tiger Woods and Andrew and I could have a conversation about the frustrations and the joys of golf that are at some level identical. So because you have that shared experience, it just connects you on the deepest possible level. And you know, any golfer who's ever had the experience of flying, you know, overseas or, you know, JFK to LAX has had that experience. It's like there's a golfer sitting next to you. The next thing you know, you're 3.5 hours into your plane and, like, you know, you're barely on the 13th hole of some round you're describing. But that's just how it goes.
And how has honing your golf skills helped you create better life skills?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I would think there's a lot to that. I would say that the golf is a very difficult game. That's why I think it will always be a niche sport. It takes a lot of dedication to get good at golf, just like it takes a lot of dedication to be good at the engineering of a podcast or to be a priest who's going to deliver a sermon that's going to connect with the particular audience that you're addressing. The actual skill set of to be a competent golfer takes work. So you have to be actually willing to do the work and put in the time. And for that reason, it's, you know, they talk about this during the pandemic, there's been this bump in golf interest because people have had the time and the opportunity to play golf. But it still is only going to appeal to a very small subset of people who are actually willing to put in the time. Otherwise, it's just too frustrating. And people are going to move on to something else like padel. Have you played padel yet?
No, but I've seen the 4 new courts.
Yeah, they're great. I mean,
they look like they're being used constantly.
They really are. Well, then when you come down sometime, let's try padel. See what happens.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room again, LIV Golf. And what's your opinion? The PGA has banned all the players that have crossed over. And do you think that's fair?
Well, yes, I do. Because it would be like, let's say you had a group of Major League Baseball players who were in the baseball union, they were meeting secretly to break away from Major League Baseball and start their own competing league. Okay, that's their right if that's what they want to do. But I think one might reasonably say, well, what you're doing is going to have a deleterious effect on what we do, which is Major League Baseball. It's been around for 100 plus years, well over. You can't play in our league anymore. That's basically what's happening in golf. Now, as is often the case, the courts are going to decide whether that was a legal move or not because there's restraint of trade issues and other things that I'm not pretending to know anything about. So I think these matters will get settled in the courts eventually. But I do think it's a reasonable position to say that you can do whatever you want. You can play for whomever you want, but that doesn't mean we're going to allow you to cherry pick and make your guaranteed millions over there and then come play here as well. So go ahead, Andrew.
Do you think I think there's an argument that overall it's good for the sport, right? Like that it's going to make it interesting and everyone's going to pay attention and, you know, there's going to be a rivalry or no.
Did Greg Norman pay you to say
no,
that?
No, I think there's an argument that
what you just said is exactly what Greg Norman believes. A lot of people believe that.
Yeah.
I happen not to believe that, but a lot of people do believe that. They actually believe that.
Well, why do people get so emotional about this?
Right.
I mean, there's the human rights abuse. If you take that out off the table.
It's hard to take it off the table.
Right.
Okay. But yes.
Sports washing.
There's sports washing. I mean, these are real things. You know, Khashoggi did walk into that embassy
alive
and came out dismembered. But let's not even go down that whole road. I think the reason, even though one could, and I would say one should, to use a word I try to avoid, it's emotional because we grew up on one thing. I mean, well, in my particular case, I grew up on the PGA Tour. I feel connected to the PGA Tour. The PGA Tour is the ultimate meritocracy. If you shoot the scores, it doesn't matter what your background is. You know, it just doesn't matter what your background is. If you shoot the scores and the scores are legitimate, you're playing by the rules, then you have the right to play. This particular league, this LIV Golf League, is more hand-picked. We like this person because of the way they look or the way they carry themselves or whatever it might be. and we're going to recruit them. We're going to pay them guaranteed money. It's not the it's a 54-hole event with a small field and guaranteed money. It's just different in every sort of way, starting with the underlying idea of a meritocratic system of achieving excellence in a difficult thing.
Well, do you think that the money is going to warp the whole thing? There are a number of events like the Masters that aren't part of the PGA where LIV players can participate. Do you wonder whether or not they have the same incentive to win a PGA event that's only going to pay out, you know, $2 or $3 million for first place when they've received $75 to $100 million to join the LIV Tour?
It's true. I don't know the answer, but I can tell you my educated guess is that golf takes a lot of OCD to get good at it and to stay good at it. Because the difference between hitting a pitch shot 40 yards and 42 yards, unless you're doing it every day, you sort of lose the feel for that. And it can be very boring and monotonous to get your body to be able to do that. The point being here, once you've got all that guaranteed money, do you really have the incentive to practice as you once did so you can distinguish between 40 and 42?
And the counterpoint, I guess, would be Koepka and Mickelson finishing second and third.
Well, right? That is a very legitimate, second and second. Yeah. Andrew, and I want to go back to something you said because there's a lot of insight into it, that is it ultimately going to be good for golf? And I know this is getting a little bit in the weeds, but so there was the Masters tournament, and it was great. Then the week after the Masters tournament, there's another event called Hilton Head. It used to be sort of a laid-back hangout kind of tournament. But now it's a so-called elevated event. It's an elevated event because the PGA Tour has poured millions of dollars into it to attract the top golf talent, and they did. So they had two players, last year's U.S. Open winner, Matthew Fitzpatrick, and another golfer who's won the U.S. Open, Jordan Spieth, playing in it. Well, that wouldn't typically happen because it was just not an event that had enough of a purse to draw those kinds of players. And then as it played out, those two players got in a playoff. Two former U.S. Open winners. So to your point is this injection of LIV money, Saudi money, and then the PGA Tour matching it and then pouring it into certain select events, is that going to be good for golf or not? Well, on this very narrow basis, one might say that it is. Someone's going to pay for those purses, and that it's not like that money comes from nowhere. Do you, it comes from anybody who's ever bought a car or bought car insurance, right. or bought a watch.
Here's why
Here's
why my instinct is it might be good for golf, and it all comes down to my wife, who's been watching Full Swing, and she's somebody who has no interest in golf or golfers. But that show,
her husband?
Well, and I'm not really a golfer, so hopefully she has some interest in me. But that show, the underlying theme of it really is LIV, right? Like, that's what drives that show. It's like, will they, won't they, are they selling out, and all of those things. And so that's creating all the drama, that really makes that show work in some ways.
Sure.
And so now, like, I think she knows more about golf now and more interest in golf. And part of it is the existence of the show, of course, but like, there's now some drama, and that in the way that there was drama when Tiger Woods was dominant too, where people really wanted to see what would happen.
Sure.
Would anyone beat him? That kind of thing. And I think it's creating interest again.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the root of drama is conflict.
Right.
And golf historically, the conflict has been the golfer against the golf course and the golfer against the golfer under this veneer of expectation of polite, genteel behavior. Now we're seeing something that we've never seen before. And for a generation that came up on WWE wrestling,
right,
it's great.
Right.
But I didn't come up
with
that.
It's a little bit like that, yeah.
Now, is there any way you can see these two organizations getting together in the future? Or is this,
there's so much bad blood right now, you're tempted to say no. But logic tells you yes, because I don't think long term, it's going to be good for golf to have these two parties warring forever. So I think eventually they'll figure something out.
It'll probably get worse before it gets better. Yeah,
could do.
Yeah.
Now, you've played golf with a lot of interesting people. I believe you played with Donald Trump. Have you played with any other presidents? And what was it like to play
Let's see here.
The Trump.
I played 9.5 rounds with Donald Trump. the single most and possibly only positive thing I can say about Donald Trump is he's fun to play golf with. You know, we don't want to turn this into a political thing.
Do you drive the golf cart onto the green, or
he drives the golf cart wherever he wants to drive with. When I played golf with Trump, I had something that he wanted, which was a good write up in Sports Illustrated for his courses. So he was following me assiduously, calling all the time. I couldn't get him off the phone. He could sell. Now, part of selling effectively is to try to figure out the buttons of the other person, and he couldn't get my buttons because the things that I value in golf are things that are foreign to him. Like, he's like, look at this waterfall. Is this not the most beautiful artificial waterfall you've ever seen? Like, Donald, I couldn't care less. What about this hamburger? Is this not the best clubhouse hamburger? Donald, I don't eat meat, you know, in other words. So, but I did say, now, but here's a little example of, you know, the fact that he actually could be charming. So we were having lunch together, and he ordered a hamburger and French fries for his son who was ill, Donnie. And they came in one of those styrofoam boxes, as they do. And they had the big steak fries at this club. And, you know, it's hot. And I said, Donald, you want to poke some forks in that styrofoam because otherwise you've got all that heat from the steak fries and the hamburger, and it's going to make everything soggy. But if you poke some holes, then then the moisture can escape. He says, that's a very creative idea. So he takes this big, heavy fork, and he pokes holes in it. 3 months later, I saw him in another golf tournament. He said, Michael, that suggestion you gave me about the holes and the styrofoam, I brought that hamburger back to Donnie and the fries. They were not soggy at all. That was fabulous. So anyway, so, you know, this is a lot. I'm really dating myself.
But he remembered.
So just to riff on this, when he was running for president, he called you and wanted you to report a certain golf score.
Yeah, no, he was.
Oh, really?
When I was writing him up for Sports Illustrated, okay. But nothing to do with his presidency. But I wrote about it later. But yeah, he said he calls. He says, Michael, I shot 68 at Bel Air, and Bel Air is this beautiful, demanding canyon golf course in Los Angeles. I said, really, Donald? 68? He's a good golfer. He could maybe shoot 78. 68, I would say, in my opinion, would be completely impossible for him to shoot a strictly kosher 68. So I said, well, Donald, who'd you play with? He said, I played with Al Michaels and these two real estate guys. I said, okay, I'll check it out. So I called one of the real estate guys. I said, oh, I heard Trump play pretty good today. And the guy said, yeah. And I said, did he break 80? No, he's claiming 68. And the guy said, well, I can't say he broke 80. I said, why not? He said, well, he took a mulligan on three. He was OB. I'm making this up, but this gives you the idea. I took a mulligan on three. He was OB on six, but he played it anyway. He never finished the eighth. He hit a lot of good shots, but I can't say he even broke 80. So now he's claiming 68 for this round. So I wrote up this long story about him, and I left out this whole discussion of whether he shot 68. And he says, Michael, you wrote that story with a lot of like. I cannot say love, as there is nothing homosexual going on here. But why did you leave out my fabulous score of 68 at Bel Air? I said, Donald, I called your guy. You didn't even break 80. What are you talking about, 68? He says, Michael, I shot 68, and you should have put it in the paper. So he doubled down on his lie. And now this is years ago.
Is there a pattern here?
Is there a pattern here, the Reverend asks. Well said,
I tell you,
sir.
When you told me that story the first time, I said, that's the measure of the man.
Yes.
Who's your favorite player?
Well, my favorite there are a number of PGA Tour players that I would definitely regard as friends, but there's one that I'm really close to, and many wouldn't know this name, but some would, and his name is Mike Donald. I've written a lot about him. Mike Donald was the runner-up in the 1990 U.S. Open. I caddied for Mike some years earlier. We have mutual friends. One's named Billy Britton from Staten Island. Grew up taking lessons under a man named Jim Albus, who was later the head pro at Piping Rock. But Mike is one of the most creative and intelligent people I've ever known in my life. Reads widely in philosophy and listens to a lot of different philosophers. Has exposed himself since he's quit playing tournament golf to all sorts of interesting thinking. Andrew, I know I can tell you want to say something here.
Well, I just keep wondering, you keep talking about caddying, and like you're a journalist, and like, do these pros let you caddy for them? How does that work?
Well, I've had periods where I have caddied in my life. I caddied as a kid for my chiefly for my high school principal. I wrote a book where I caddied on the PJ tour for part of a year and wrote a book about it. Then I caddied on the European tour and wrote about it. I caddied in the Masters once and wrote about it. So for me, the caddying is a way. I mean, I love the caddying. I love being inside the ropes and seeing really good golf up close. But it's also a way for me to get to understand the game at a much deeper level than I could just as a reporter.
Amazing.
So here's a thought. We've got to wind up as scintillating as it's been.
I could do this for another hour.
And we've got another hour coming up in the Parish Hall when I interview you there, and there are a lot of other questions to ask. But, you know, we call this the calling, and you clearly have found your calling. This is just who you are.
You call this podcast the calling?
It is the calling.
Do you know what Jim Nantz calls his wine?
The calling. There we go. So... what advice would you give to someone who's never found their calling and they're wondering, am I meant for something more? How do you get into that flow or find that place to say, this utilizes all my gifts and talents, or so many of them, and it fulfills me and helps me come fully alive?
That is a profound question. I'm guessing, Merrick, that you've asked others that question and you've asked your parishioners that question. And I wish I had an answer to that question, because yes, for what you're doing and for what I'm doing, we were lucky to find something that really engages us. And for me, I know it sounds like it's the golf in this conversation, and definitely the golf is part of it, but the real answer is trying to figure out the people. That's been my life's work. Why do people do the things they do, good, bad, and otherwise? And in your line of work, pretty much the same. Now you've got salvation and redemption and other things on your mind that I would imagine that I don't. The only short answer, not a profound one, because many would say the same, is exposure. Read widely, travel widely, think widely, talk widely. You know, you and I are both reporters at heart. The act of reporting isn't limited to being a reporter. I think it comes out of a desire to understand another person's experience. If you can really open yourself to another person's experience, you have a chance of enriching yourself to a point where you might find a path and a direction of something that's going to enrich you in every way. But having said that, Merrick, I would say if you just look at life realistically, we're in some lucky small percentage. Most people have a job, whether it's being a plumber or a mechanic or teaching school or being a nurse, being a full-time caregiver, for whatever it might be. That isn't an ends to a mean. They don't have this driving passion for it. That's the majority of life and the majority of the population. So I know there's no really simple answer. I know sometimes I've picked up on, in almost an envy, like, wow, this guy found something at a young age and it never started to bore him. He never got bored of it. How is that possible? But, you know, part of it is luck, DNA, really. So I wish I had a profound answer for you, and I don't, but I do appreciate the question. I think it's a question everybody can and should ask themselves and ask their loved ones as well.
Hey, thank you, Michael. What a joy it's been to have you
thank
here.
Thank you very much.
And we hope we can get you back sometime, and we're off to play a little miniature golf now. Work on your short game.
Do you mind if I pose that same question back at you?
Oh, the advice to someone who hasn't found their calling. I would, Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss. And if you follow the thing that gives you the greatest joy and just pursue it with a passion, I think, so to speak, the money will follow, or you can make a livelihood at that. Because you'll come fully alive, and people love when someone's fully alive and found their thing, and they're so excited about it. People want to be around people like that. It's so sad when you see someone who's settled for something that they were never meant to do. their mother wanted them to be a doctor or their father, and but they would have made a great lawyer, a great teacher, a great soccer coach. But they were channeled to do something that wasn't their aptitude and didn't make them come alive. And so if you just trust your gut, when, you know, and part of that is other people will tell you, you've got a gift for this. Have you ever thought of doing this? Or, and it might be something you do as an avocation. Some people, that has to be it. You know, they've got a family, they've got three children, and they've got college payments to do and stuff like that. You can't walk away from all that. But you can do something on the side as a volunteer, whether it's serving at your church or doing something in the community or teaching golf on the side. While you make your living something else. But if you're young and able to do it, really follow your bliss and honor that. And God has a way of taking care of the rest.
Well said.
Thanks again.
Thank you.